Welcome, everybody, to the first class on the Rothbardian analysis of the state. And I think one good reason to take the course is there's an article on lewrothwell.com by Walter Block a few weeks ago, and the theme was, if you want to know why Ron Paul is so critical of government intervention, read Murray Rothbard. And if you want to know how he comes up with all of his arguments and his analyses that make him so different than all the other politicians, read Rothbard. And that's very true. And so just as an ordinary citizen, it's a good idea to familiarize yourself with the work of Murray Rothbard and his analysis. And of course, Rothbard was also a great scholar and really a brilliant man. And so if you're on the path to becoming a scholar, or if you already are, it's also worthwhile to take this course as well, because I'll be throwing out a lot of suggested readings and, on top of the syllabus for anyone who would want to pursue them. And if you excuse me for a minute, I got a little cold here. I've been struggling with the last couple of days. But I thought I'd get into Rothbard's basic analysis of the state and these two essays that I put on the syllabus for the first week of the class. And then for the second week, since Rothbard in a lot of his writings referred to John C. Calhoun, and he praises Calhoun as one of the best American political philosophers in history, I thought it would be very worthwhile to take a look at Calhoun's Disquisition on Government, which is also online. And the other short little article I put for next week is by Clyde Wilson, the retired history professor at the University of South Carolina, who's also the editor of the 28-volume collected works of John C. Calhoun. And so I thought a short, terse little article by Professor Wilson would be a good accompaniment to that short book by Calhoun, monograph, really. But getting into Rothbard's discussion of the state, the first point he makes, of course, is that the advocates of statism have always made the argument that, well, we are the state, the people are the state under democracy. Whatever the state does, it reflects us, the voters. And, of course, we think of this as being mostly the domain of leftists, socialists of various sorts, but there are also some conservatives out there who would never call themselves socialists, and they aren't socialists, who make the same argument. And I'm thinking in particular of my old professor, James Buchanan, who is still on the faculty at George Mason in Virginia. And much of his career has been spent on developing something called constitutional economics. And Rothbard was very critical of Buchanan and then public choice also during his time. And what Jim Buchanan, my old professor, says is that this whole area is his attempt to create a voluntary theory of the state. And so you have conservatives like Buchanan really doing the same thing that leftists have done forever in trying to make people think that the state is voluntary and that what it does is just a reflection of us and that we would consent. And Buchanan started out recognizing that there, of course, is never any unanimity in government, and therefore coercion is necessary. It might be, and so he then resorted to saying, well, maybe relative unanimity is better than just simple majority, but then you still have 70 or 80% coercing a minority, and that idea didn't really fly as a means to argue that the state is voluntary. And so after that, Buchanan came up with the concept of conceptual unanimity, and he's published a lot of articles and even books on this idea of just imagining in a state of nature where there is no government, if and people are more or less blind about what governments would do, would they want to adopt a government and all the various features of government, from antitrust laws to you name it. And invariably, Buchanan says yes. And so he, a well-known conservative, sometimes even considered to be a libertarian, has spent the past 40 years really making the argument that behind the veil of ignorance, people would conceivably go along with creating all sorts of government interventions. There's an economist named Leland Yeager who used to teach at Auburn University. He's retired now. He wrote a paper in the Cato Journal some years ago, probably 15 or 20 years ago now, criticizing this idea. And he made the argument that if you ever see the word conceptual before the word unanimity in the literature, change that to the word no, and you'll know what they're talking about, no unanimity. And of course, unanimous agreement is the domain of the market. When we have voluntary exchange, we have unanimous agreement between buyers and sellers. And so the state can never be like the market. And that's really the point that Rothbard is making here, that there are a lot of people who are just playing fast and loose with certain facts in their analysis and trying to make the argument that the state is somehow voluntary. And I have to take another break to blow my nose. I'm sorry about this, but I've got this cold. Okay, that's better. Now, and of course, you don't say these things in polite company, but the state is based on using force, violence, and intimidation to get its money. That's why so many people, so many economists, stay away from Rothbard. They don't want to get near him because that's just the type of thing you don't say in polite company in economics departments in the academic world. But of course, it's absolutely true. It's undeniable that that's how the state gets its revenue. If you don't believe that, try not paying the federal income tax someday and see what happens. The state does have enough guns with which to force you to pay the income tax, and therefore you will pay the income tax or go to jail, one or the other. And so, and of course, you may contrast this with the free market. And what he's getting at here is the old idea that was written up very eloquently in the book that he cites by Frank Oppenheimer called The State, which I would highly recommend that anyone read. If you want to know the kind of ideas that influenced Murray Rothbard, The State by Franz Oppenheimer, it had a profound effect on him. And there are two ways to make money. You can serve your fellow man in the marketplace, or you can use politics to coerce money out of the pocket of your fellow man and put it into your pocket in return for nothing. Those are the only two ways of making money. And the second way, of course, is the domain of criminals and of government, the use of coercion. And in modern economic parlance, he's really talking about profit-seeking versus what some modern economists of the public choice school call rent-seeking, using the organs of the state to transfer income or wealth from one person to another, whether it's through lobbying or whatever means. That's what he's talking about. And Rothbard also makes reference to a large literature that is cited in this great book, The State, by Oppenheimer, that is called The Conquest Theory of Government. Rothbard makes the point that the free market has to exist first to create wealth, and then governments came, because you can't confiscate wealth that doesn't exist. And so the origins of the state, says Rothbard, were that there were people peacefully cooperating, creating a free market, trading with each other, creating wealth. And a small gang comes along and says, we are the government, and we will protect you, but first we must take some of your wealth. And that's how governments were formed. And but Oppenheimer cites sociological and anthropological research that was published over the decades that shows that this has, in fact, been the case over the centuries in the formation of states. It's not just a theory of Murray Rothbard. It's based on historical reality, going back hundreds and hundreds of years. And so that's called the conquest theory of the state. And Rothbard does make the point of it's related to this, that there never was any social contract, that there never was an example of people getting together and signing some sort of contract to create the state to voluntarily tax themselves. That's all just a fanciful theory. It never happened like that in reality. There are a lot of people who wish that was the case, and they talk about the social contract. But ask yourself if you or anyone you know has ever signed such a contract. What kind of contract is it that no one is, that you know has ever signed? And yet we're all supposed to be bound by this so-called contract. So the next question that Rothbard looks at is, you know, how does the state preserve itself? Once the state exists, it comes around by force, by just announcing, we are the state, we are going to tax you. Then what happens? How does it maintain its power? Well, of course, it uses force. It uses violence. It always has a police force and a military force to throw its weight around. But that can be very expensive. And also, if you brutalize the public too much, the public will revolt. And it's important to understand that all governments, even the totalitarian governments like the Soviet Union, were always only comprised of a small minority of the population. You know, even the Soviet Union was a few thousand people at the top who ran the government, and they were outnumbered by many tens of millions of people. And so, you know, force is one tool, but there's always the prospect of a revolution that will just overwhelm and overthrow the people who run the government, even if they do have a lot of guns, a lot of weaponry. And so governments need to use more than just force to keep themselves in power. And they use, so they use at least two other tools. One is the creation of vested interests, make it in the financial interest of a lot of people to be tied to the government. And this, you know, some of you have read some of my books, you know, something about my book, Hamilton's Curse, where I write of how at the very beginning of the American Republic, Alexander Hamilton, who was very Machiavellian in his outlook, he wanted to tie the interests of the wealthy people of America to the government by having a large public debt. He understood that the wealthier people would be the owners of the government bonds. They're the ones who had the money with which to purchase government bonds, and therefore they would become a potent lobbying block for higher taxes in the future, because they would want to make sure there's enough money in the Treasury to pay off more interest on their bonds, on their government bonds. And so that's the type of thing what Rothbard is mentioning here. And then, of course, contractors, defense contractors, and others who profit from being associated with government. But then the big thing is ideology, statist ideology. All states are dependent on a series of myths about how wonderful they are, how magnanimous they are, how they are our saviors, our protectors. They're the night watchmen. They're the referee who enforces the rules. They have all sorts of stories about how wonderful they are. At the same time, they will tell us through their government schools that the civil society is inadequate. It ignores the poor. It ignores the hungry. The private sector creates monopoly and rips off the public. And, of course, you need the state to defend us from all of that. And so ideology is a very important part of pulling the wool over the eyes of the public about the true nature of the state. And, of course, once the state monopolizes the country's educational system, it has a relatively easy time of doing that. And so the state needs intellectuals as myth makers, creators of myths. About the wonders of the state and the evils of the private sector and the civil society. And so you have to ask yourself, well, what's in it for the intellectuals? Why do the intellectuals, who you would normally think rely on their reputation for being truth seekers, why would they become myth makers for the state? Well, the answer is prestige, power, and money. A good example would be the Keynesian Revolution of the 1930s and 40s, when economists and some other social scientists who had been living their lives teaching in a small college somewhere in the American Midwest all of a sudden became potential advisors to the government and paid advisors to the government. They got invited to go to Washington, D.C. They got invited to apply for jobs in government agencies. And when they left the government agencies, they would have endowed chairs at famous universities because they had been in touch with the powerful people in the Roosevelt administration. And so, you know, what's in it for the intellectuals is power, prestige, and money. And we see that today. Just look around, read Paul Krugman in the New York Times. I just put on my office door today a picture of Krugman with a quote from him in the year 2002 saying Alan Greenspan needs to create a housing bubble to replace the NASDAQ bubble, which had just burst. And that's the kind of thing you say, advocating more government power, even though it's totally wrongheaded. But it gets you a position as a columnist in the New York Times, and you make a lot of money, and you're very happy. Another good example of this is there's a female author in America named Doris Kearns Goodwin. She confessed about 5 or 6 years ago to plagiarism, to plagiarizing hundreds of pages to another author, and she confessed to paying a six-figure sum to the author whose work she stole. And she was kicked off the Pulitzer Prize Committee. She was kicked off of PBS for a few months. And then after lying low for a few months, she's back on television. She has a big book contract to write a book on Abraham Lincoln, which is now being turned into a movie. And her previous history, by the way, is writing biographies of the Kennedy family and the Roosevelt family. And so she's a court historian who writes about how glorious and wonderful the Kennedys and the Roosevelts were. And in return, she can even get away with plagiarism and still be a star on television informing the American public on who they should vote for president. So you can get away with anything if you're a court intellectual like Doris Kearns Goodwin or Paul Krugman. And of course, they're a very important part of the state and how the state keeps its power. That's why they hate people like us at the Mises Institute. Because we keep stripping the emperor's clothes off, and that's why governments also hate the internet. Rothbard also talks about the role of the church in solidifying the power of government, and it has always been used to some degree to try to convince the people that whatever the government is doing is God's will. Some of you may even remember that George W. Bush once said that he ran for president because he was sitting in church one day and God spoke to him and told him to run for president. A lot of people bought that. The so-called evangelicals supported him and will support whoever else says such things. But on another level, you often see special interest groups of all sorts, labor unions, for example, getting ministers or preachers or priests involved in their movement because they want the public to think that what is in their narrow economic self-interest of a labor union, for example, is really God's will. It's really God's will that their narrow public interest of say, a public employee union is really the general interest. It's really the interest of the general public, and God would approve of that. And so it's not unusual to see religious people involved in these sorts of efforts, and the government is and the government's appendages, like public employee unions, are happy to have the clergy involved. Okay, and that's the point that Rothbard is making. Excuse me again. The governments always have to generate fear of other states, and especially fear of anarchy, fear of in the public's mind, of no government. That's the worst thing of all. That's why you have a constant parade of boogeymen from Saddam Hussein to the president of Iran in today's world. There's always another Hitler on the horizon in some circles. And the state has to keep us constantly in fear of some other state attacking us. And another point that Martin Rothbard makes is he sort of briefly talks about the history of warfare. And, you know, in the Middle Ages and for quite some time after the Middle Ages, warfare was usually between kings would have mercenary armies, and the battles that were fought would be one monarch attempting to steal the wealth of another monarch, and they would hire mercenary soldiers to do so. And the wars really didn't involve the general public much. They were wars between the rulers themselves and their paid mercenaries. And then that all changed when the idea of nationalism was invented, so that the monarchs could claim that the war was really the entire nation being attacked by another nation or another ruler, not just him as a threat. And so once that happened, you know, conscription came along shortly thereafter. And of course, a tremendous propaganda campaign commenced to convince everyone that wars that were really between rulers, two sets of rulers, were involved everyone, which, of course, they didn't. Another point about how the state keeps its power is there's always an attack on individuals and the philosophy of individualism, while a glorification of collectivism occurs at the same time. In Friedrich Hayek's book, The Constitution of Liberty, he devotes a whole chapter to the idea of how all socialist regimes of all kinds always had as one of their priorities an attack on the idea of self-responsibility, of individualism in the sense of self-responsibility. You're responsible for your own behavior, your own actions, because if the public believe or not responsible for your own actions, well, who is? Well, the state. The state needs to guide you along and take responsibility for your life, make sure you have enough to eat, you know, enough schooling and so forth. And therefore, the state needs to be in charge of food distribution and running the schools and so forth. And so there's always been an attack on individualism and at the same time the glorification of collectivism. Government policy is always made in the name of the common good, the general good, the common weal, and so forth. But of course there is no such thing in government because that implies unanimity. It implies that if it's in the public good and we're all parts of the public, the implication is this policy must benefit everybody and benefit equally for that matter. But of course that is never the case in government. Government is lying to us when it makes these arguments. And the critics of the state are usually smeared as conspiracy theorists. I've been tagged by that plenty of times. When my book Hamilton's Curse came out, I was on MSNBC, the Morning Joe television program, and I sat next to Patrick Buchanan. My book was a critique of Alexander Hamilton. Buchanan told me that Hamilton is his hero, so I knew that wasn't going to go well. But you know, after allowing me about 10 seconds to describe the entire book, they started asking me questions about what caused the current economic crisis and what would you do about it. And I said the separation of money and state is a first step. And they immediately said something like, oh, you're one of those conspiracy theorists, Council on Foreign Relations. And so these elitists on MSNBC immediately use the textbook routine of attacking anyone who advocates freedom as being some sort of conspiracy theorist. And of course, I wasn't espousing any conspiracy theory. I was espousing sound economic policy. But that's the sort of thing that Rothbard is talking about when he talks about critics of the state being smeared as conspiracy theorists. And of course, conspiracies do exist. It's one thing to talk about a conspiracy to cover up the supposed fact that Martians landed in New Mexico in the 1950s. Yeah, there are crazy conspiracy theorists like that. But I think it's important to recognize that just about everything that goes on in Washington, D.C. on a daily basis is a conspiracy of some sort. It's a group of people getting together, plotting to rob the Treasury one way or another, to have a special regulation passed that will harm their competitors and benefit them, and so on and so forth. We even have laws that outlaw conspiracies and restraint of trade, for example. So yes, there are conspiracies, to be sure. And so it's not necessarily a bad thing to label somebody as a conspiracy theorist. Another word for conspiracy would be lobbying. You need to be a lobbying theorist as well as a conspiracy theorist. And of course, private success has to be denigrated as greed. That's why you hear this language about people wanting to give back, successful people who make money in the market. It's kind of sickening to me when I hear them say, I'm donating $1 million to some charity because I need to give back, as though they stole the money in the first place, which of course they did not if they engaged in a legal, peaceful activity in the marketplace. But that's the mentality that has been inculcated in Americans anyway about the market. There also has to be an assault on common sense to be used to solidify governmental power. And I would use Keynesianism as Rothbard does as an example of this. What did Keynes himself and his followers, the Keynesians, tell us? Well, they told us saving your money is bad. Don't save your money. It's a bad thing to save money because there's this theory there that's called the paradox of thrift. And it goes something like this. The more you save, the less you consume. If you consume less, that'll be bad for the economy. The economy will go into a recession. You may lose your job, and then you won't be able to save anything. So that saving more eventually causes you to save less. I'm not making this up. This is what I was taught when I was an undergraduate economics student many years ago. That's called the paradox of thrift. Savings is antisocial. Paul Samuelson even wrote in one of his textbooks that we don't really need the wealthy anymore because savings is so antisocial, so bad for us. And that, of course, is who does most of the savings, people who have money, a lot of money. And we don't need the rich. Yay, according to Samuelson. And, of course, we don't need them. We don't need the products and services they create through entrepreneurship either. Samuelson didn't say that, but that's the implication of what he said in his textbook. This is a textbook used by millions of college students over the decades. So that's one piece of nonsense that they told us, you know, not recognizing that savings is what fuels capital accumulation, and capital accumulation is what is necessary for investment and economic growth to take place. Then there's the theory of the multiplier effect, where I was taught as a student that if a government takes $1 billion out of the taxpayers' pockets and then spends that $1 billion, through the magic of the multiplier effect, the economy will actually become increased by more than $1 billion. And the implication of that is that if we all sent every penny of our paychecks to Washington, D.C., it could come back maybe tenfold, depending on how big the multiplier effect is. So if you made $1,000 a week, send all 1,000 to Washington, D.C., and it may come back as 2,000. GDP will increase. That's the multiplier effect. And that's the type of nonsense that was taught. Another part of Keynesianism is that we should not worry about government debt. There's nothing to worry about because we owe it to ourselves. That's what one of the arguments that they made is we owe it to ourselves. And so this is a very collectivist way of thinking because, of course, there are individuals who buy government debt and who profit or not from buying government debt. And there are other individuals, different individuals, who pay the taxes to pay off the bonds that other people owe. So it's not, there's no we involved. There are just different sets of individuals who benefit from government borrowing and who pay and who lose from government borrowing, as far as that's concerned. And so there has to be an attack on common sense, and you see it every day, not every day, but every week in the New York Times if you read Paul Krugman's columns. That's, you know, talk about an attack on common sense. There's a website by our friend Bill Anderson called Krugman in Wonderland that you might consult if you're interested in this this whole idea. But that's probably the best idea or example of this. Now there's another discussion on how the state transcends its limits. People have always tried to limit the state one way or another. Originally, there was the idea of divine sovereignty. And this was hundreds of years ago in Europe. And the idea was that kings should not do anything that would be in conflict with Scripture. They should behave as moral men, and what the things that they do should be in accordance with God's word, and that's divine sovereignty. That was transformed by politicians, by the kings themselves, to mean anything the king never did was necessarily ordained by God, and because by virtue of the fact that the king did it. And so if you were opposing the king or criticizing the king, you were said to be criticizing God himself. So that idea, it was meant to be something that would restrict the power of kings, was transformed into something that would create unlimited power by the kings. The idea of natural rights, which colors all the American founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, the Constitution, where the basic idea is that Americans, or American people, human beings, have God-given natural rights to life, liberty, and property, property that is peacefully acquired, that is, and that the sole purpose of government is to secure those rights, period. That's the role of government. That's what was behind most of the founding fathers in their thinking about the role of government. Well, that was transformed by the time you get to the 1930s, especially to the idea that individuals in the United States have a right to housing, they have a right to a job, and all these things. And of course, if you have a right to all these individual things, then someone else in society has an obligation to pay for them. So that's a very different idea. But that's how this natural rights idea, which was meant to limit government, was transformed over time as an argument to create unlimited government. It's only limited by the imagination of politicians in terms of what they claim we all have a right to. If we have a right to a house, why don't we have a right to a mansion? Why is just a house? The sky's the limit. The U.S. Constitution was subverted from the very beginning. The American founders thought that a written constitution, most of them did anyway, that a written constitution could be used to constrain the government. And the original idea of the Jeffersonian wing of the founders was that the most important part of this constitution was the 10th Amendment. And what they meant was the rest of the Constitution, especially Article 1, Section 8, created what are known as the delegated powers. There are only about 17 different things the federal government is empowered to do. That's what it is supreme in doing. There's something called the Supremacy Clause in the U.S. Constitution, and it says that the U.S. government, the federal government, is supreme in those things, only those things, not everything, those 17 things. And then the 10th Amendment says the people and the states, respectively, have all the other power responsible for everything else. And the idea of Jefferson and the Jeffersonians was that the people themselves organized through political communities at the state and local level would have to be the enforcers of the Constitution. If the day ever came, Jefferson believed, that the federal government itself became the sole arbiter of constitutionality, then Americans would live under a tyranny. If the day ever came that the Supreme Court alone would be deciding on constitutional issues, the Supreme Court being just an arm of the federal government, then Americans will no longer live in a free country. And that, of course, is the system we live in today and have for many, many years. It started after the American Civil War. By 1865, there was no more talk of nullification or secession, and that's when the Supreme Court became the sole arbiter of constitutionality. And it didn't take them that long to decide that there really were no limits on government. And that was the original design of some of the connivers in the government, led by such people as Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton's view of the U.S. Constitution was that it could be a convenient tool used by people like him who wanted government to have more or less unlimited powers to put a rubber stamp on anything the government ever did. Jefferson's view was that government should be bound by the chains of the Constitution. Those are his exact words. Hamilton's view was exactly the opposite, that if properly interpreted by clever lawyers like himself, the Constitution could be used to put a rubber stamp on unlimited government power. And that, of course, is where we are today. The Hamiltonians have won that battle ideologically, as far as that's concerned. And this started at the very beginning when Hamilton and Jefferson actually had an argument or a debate over the constitutionality of a central bank. Hamilton wanted it, Jefferson did not. And Jefferson and Hamilton wrote reports that were sent to George Washington. Jefferson pointed out that the Constitutional Convention did consider a central bank, a national bank, and they rejected the idea. And it exists nowhere in the written Constitution. Hamilton came back by saying, you must read between the lines. There are implied powers of the Constitution. And so right at the very beginning, this is 1780, politicians were inventing the idea of implied powers of the Constitution that were not actually written down in the Constitution. And once you go that route, then the powers of the government are limited, only limited by the imagination of the politicians who are given the ability to interpret the Constitution. And so we have gone a long way down that road in the United States, and the Constitution was subverted and neutered as an effective limit on governmental power many generations ago in America, which is why it is just mystifying why so many politicians, still conservative politicians, still are so worshipful of the Constitution. How would it be enforced? You can't rely on the Supreme Court, that's for sure. If history teaches us anything at all, it's that government cannot be limited by a written constitution alone. That's why Rothbard next talks about how the early Jeffersonians understood that nullification was a necessary power of the people, where people could gather in groups by the state level or groups of states and simply declare that they would not allow the enforcement of some federal law that they believe to be unconstitutional within their borders, or secession could take place. Excuse me again. And the ultimate check on the power of the state would be secession or the threat of secession. And that did work very well for quite a long time. And you know, in the original Constitution, U.S. senators were appointed by state legislators. And the reason for that was that if a senator went to Washington, D.C. and promised to do one thing at home and did a different thing when he got to Washington, D.C., he could be fired immediately. And quite a few senators were in the early days until the 17th Amendment came around in 1913 that created the direct election of senators. So, and these are all elements of what are called states' rights or federalism in America that was meant to bolster the idea that a constitution could be used to limit a state. Of course, the American Civil War, so-called, ended that. It ended nullification, it ended secession, certainly. And the idea of nullification is making a bit of a comeback. Some politicians are talking about it now, but the proof is in the pudding. We'll see if they actually walk the walk, as they say, after talking the talk about nullification. Okay. And Rothbard also makes the point that the nullifiers never went far enough, and that they should have, were the advocates of secession, and that it shouldn't have just been constrained at the state level. It should have been gone all the way down to the individual. And if you really want a free society, individuals should be allowed to secede and live on their own in a stateless society as well. Another important point that Rothbard makes here is that the state is always relentlessly anti-capitalist. It is relentlessly waging war on capitalism. Just look at what government does to businesses. Taxes, corporation income tax, capital gains tax, hundreds, thousands of regulations of every aspect of every business. There's an article on Mises.org by George Reisman that was published a couple of years ago, taking on this ludicrous argument that the current economic crisis was caused by laissez-faire. And he just goes down a list of some of the government agencies that exist in relation to housing, just housing. And it's mind-boggling. You know, something like 9 cabinet departments, and dozens of bureaucracies, and that's just housing. And so government strangles every business in America with reams and reams of regulations and taxes of all sorts. If Karl Marx himself were to be reincarnated and come back to Earth, given the power to destroy capitalism, he would certainly approve of the fine head start the U.S. government has given him in destroying capitalism in America with government regulation of all sorts. Not to mention the anti-business propaganda that is spread among other places through American business schools, almost all of which are government-funded to a very large extent. And so the censorship of free market ideas comes in a lot of subtle ways in business schools, but you would think that business schools of all places would not have anti-business propaganda, but they do. It's called social responsibility of business, which is essentially a large body of literature in academia arguing for more and more government control of business. And who wants to be socially irresponsible? You know, the language is very interesting here. And so so the state is always relentlessly anti-capitalist, even to the extent that it nationalizes industries, such as Obama partially nationalized the automobile industry not too long ago. And another important point, and this is, it should be obvious, but in today's world, is that the state's major interest is in protecting itself, not so much protecting us. And Rothbard says, well, just look at the types of penalties that are involved in a crime against the state compared to similar crimes against individuals. You know, look at what happens when a police officer is murdered compared to this, an ordinary person is murdered. I've blogged on numerous occasions on lewrothwell.com about how in Baltimore, where I work, every time a police officer dies, even if he dies of old age, they shut down the interstate for part of the afternoon. There are hundreds and hundreds of police cars from all over the several states that form a parade and have a gigantic funeral. It's in the front page of the newspaper for several days, and they have fire trucks and police cars everywhere, traffic jams galore. And, you know, the same day, if an ordinary citizen dies or is murdered the same day in Baltimore, no one ever hears of it. You know, you wait a week and there might be a tiny obituary in the back of the paper. So crimes, not even crimes, but just the death of government bureaucrats is made such a big deal in so many places. A former city council woman in Baltimore passed away and died of, you know, old age in her late 80s, not too long ago. There was a, you know, gigantic spread on the front page of the newspaper about this, as though she was some kind of a saint and not just another hack politician who took bribes her whole life from real estate developers and other shady characters in the political world. And that's what Rothbard is talking about here. And look, another illustration of his point is in the current economic crisis, if you kept track of the public employee unions and what they've been up to, something like only less than 2% of public employees have actually lost their jobs, you know, during the current economic crisis. So despite all the hand-wringing about cutbacks and budget cuts and at the state level of government, employment has pretty much remained constant except for some attrition through retirement. And so they've taken care of their own very well. Well, at the same time, there are many corporations that have laid off tens of thousands of workers, or if not gone bankrupt altogether, but not the bureaucrats. The bureaucrats have all kept their jobs for the most part, and they've done everything they can to raise taxes and find money somewhere else to make sure that they're all still on the payroll. Very few of them have lost their jobs. Another important point about how the state solidifies its power is to monopolize the commanding heights of the economy. The police and the military are used to keep us all in line, even though there are actually more private police in America than there are government police. All the private security guards at all the malls and the homeowners associations employ, they actually outnumber the number of government police, but of course the government police are much better funded and much better armed than the private security guards are in America. They monopolize the law and the courts, even though there's a long, centuries-long history of private law that doesn't need to be monopolized by the government. But of course the money, you know, the free market adopted gold as its money. That evolved over generations when people decided that gold was the best form of money, and then government stepped in, confiscates gold, detaches paper money from gold, and establishes its own fiat currencies and monopolizes the money supply that way, creating boom and bust cycles and eternal economic strife which it then blames on capitalism or greed. Transportation, the government has to monopolize transportation, has to regulate the roads, control the roads, the skies, the trains, and so forth, because it has to control where we go. It has to control us. I saw this in an extreme case a couple of years ago. Excuse me again. When I flew into Prague. And I flew into Prague, and there were just acres and acres and acres of high-rise apartment buildings. And the rest of the area around the airport there was kind of rural-looking, but there was this huge concentration of apartment buildings. And then also in Prague, they have the tram, the train that the communists built, that has a fixed route. And so the people would go from these congregations of apartments to wherever the government wanted them to go, to the factory, to the mill, to wherever they worked, and then back. Those are the government-approved routes. And so if you want to know where this idea comes from of what in America is called smart growth by a lot of mayors and local politicians, it was the communists who decided it would be easier to control people if you could corral them all into one spot to live where they could be watched, and more importantly today, where they could be easily taxed, and then put them all on government-run transportation trains so they can continue to be watched and controlled and can't have much freedom of movement, because that's not good for the state. You don't want people to have too much independence. And so that's an extreme example of what Rothbard is talking about when he says governments always monopolize transportation. And of course they always control the rivers and the coastlines, et cetera, and the mail. They want to be able to censor the mail. Some of you know I've written several books on Lincoln. And I've written about how during the Lincoln administration, his critics, some of the newspapers were simply shut down, and the printing presses destroyed by mobs of Republican Party thugs. But also, the mails were used to censor criticism of the Lincoln administration, because in those days, newspapers were delivered by mail. There weren't many, if any, newspaper delivery boys. And so if you didn't have access to the U.S. mail, you could not be a business as a newspaper in the 1860s. And so the Lincoln administration censored criticism to a very large extent by shutting down a lot of newspapers, more than 300 of them. And then others, but the vehicle that was used to shut down a lot of them was denying them access to the U.S. mails. And so that's always been a tool to keep the people from having too much control over the government. Some extra points that are worth talking about here are Rothbard brings up the subject of the free rider problem in economics. The basic idea is that if what is being produced is a so-called public good, it's of the type like national defense is always used as a typical example of a public good, people have an incentive to freeload and let other people pay for it if it's voluntary, thinking, well, if they really want this thing, someone will pick up the bill. I can free ride on George, let George pay for it. And as a result, we will not get sufficient funding of this needed good. And there are a lot of criticisms of this. One of them is that there's no way of revealing what people's true preferences are for such things. The government simply usually announces that it thinks we should have these things in the amounts it declares, but there's no actual mechanism for revealing our preferences for these things. And another aspect of this is that there is a good bit of literature in economics about certain public goods that in theory it seemed like it would make sense that there would be a lot of free riders, people wouldn't pay for it. But I'll give one example. There's a famous article in economics by Ronald Coase called The Lighthouse in Economics, where Coase took the example of the lighthouse, which had long been given as an example of a public good that suffered from the free rider problem, therefore government needed to step in and finance lighthouses so that ships wouldn't wreck on the shorelines. And in a nutshell, he did a historical survey of the history of the lighthouse industry in England, and found that the merchants who invested millions of pounds on putting their cargo on ocean-going ships were not so stupid as to allow their ships to go up and down the coast and crash on the rocks in a foggy harbor. And so they found it to be in their own self-interest to finance lighthouses so that their ships and their cargo would be safe. And so there was a long history of the private financing of lighthouses. And then it was overtaken eventually by government, which governments usually do. They become imperialistic and take over the good functions of the private sector, initiates all the time. The same is true of police. In the American West, for example, communities police themselves. The wagon trains have their own policing mechanisms. So did the mining camps and others before there were any governments at all in the western part of the United States, and then the government stepped in and monopolized the police function later. But it was working very well in comparison to today's, certainly in comparison to today's government police, you know, back in the earlier days of the American Republic. I guess it's worth talking about this crazy idea that voting makes government voluntary somehow, that as long as we vote. I would recommend on this an article of mine on lewrockwell.com entitled Be Patriotic, Don't Vote. And the argument I make is that since no one in Washington, apart from Ron Paul, takes the U.S. Constitution seriously anymore, and we live in a regime of unlimited government, that when you vote, all you're doing is adding credence to the regime. You're adding legitimacy to the regime. That's why whoever is elected president always announces that the people have spoken, I have a mandate. Or whenever the Congress changes hands from Democrat to Republican, or vice versa, the party in power and control always claims the people have spoken, we have a mandate. And so you're just adding credence or legitimacy to the regime. But what they do does not make government voluntary. Just use one example of war. Wars are usually started by secret connivings by a small group of people in the executive branch with the help of a few people in Congress, and the public is totally in the dark about it. The war starts, and the public, of course, had nothing whatsoever to do with the starting of the war. And so how could voting, the mere act of voting, be construed as something that makes you responsible for the war? It can't. Okay, it doesn't make government voluntary. It doesn't mean that you consented to that war. But that's the argument that a lot of people make. And of course, Rothbard also, in both of these essays that I put on the reading list, he mentions secession. And of course, that is one thing that is would put a dagger to the heart of the state, is that groups of individuals by the state or wherever could simply secede and say, leave me alone, I don't want any benefits from government, and I don't want to pay taxes to government either. Well, we can't have that. And so nothing will bring on the ire of the court historians and the kept intellectuals than an advocate of secession like myself and Murray Rothbard. And they will call you a racist, a traitor, a terrorist, and so forth, in any type of hysterical language to discredit the idea of secession, which really is the only true idea of voluntary government. If government really is voluntary, then citizens should be able to say, I want to be a part of it, or I do not want to be a part of it. And so, without the right of secession, all talk about voluntary taxation, voluntary government, government by consent, is all nonsense. It's just blather aimed at pulling the wool over the public's eyes. And finally, the final thing I'll mention, I guess, my time is, I usually lecture for about 45 minutes or so, by the way, and then I'll take questions. And since this is the first class, any questions on the chat, I'll sit here and answer it to the best of my ability, for as long as we have questions up there. The last thing Rothbard, I'll mention, is that Rothbard makes the case that lying to the state is moral. Lying to the government is moral. And he asks the question, if a robber is robbing your house and asks you, where is the jewelry hidden, and you lie to him, is that an immoral thing? Is that an immoral thing to lie to the robber? And he says, no, it's not. And so he equates the state to a gang of robbers, and says it's not immoral. And he also says that doesn't mean you should lie if you're in a court of law, take the oath not to lie, because he doesn't want you to end up in prison. But just as a theoretical or philosophical argument, it is not immoral to lie to the state. But of course, keep in mind, you can go to jail if you do this sort of thing. Okay, and so I think that's my sort of overview or summary of the Rothbardian idea of how states are created and how they solidify their power and keep themselves in power. And I think it's a very important part of the whole Rothbardian worldview about government that I think is very beneficial in coloring your view of what government is all about in a much more realistic way than most people have. And so I urge you all to read these essays. They're both very enlightening. The Anatomy of the State is a very famous Rothbardian essay for that matter. And I'll look through and see, think of some questions. I'll see what I can do to answer them. Okay, Tony says he bought Lincoln Unmasked today, 80% off at Borders, going on a business sale. That's not good. Okay, Roger has a question. Has the idea of voluntary taxation ever existed? Well, in the original American Republic, I can speak to American history, income taxation was out of the picture. It was not acceptable to have a tax on income until the income tax amendment in 1913. And so there were taxes. Taxes are mostly tariffs and a few excise taxes, which were not voluntary. So in American history, there had never been voluntary taxation. If it's voluntary, it's not really a government. It's just a club or a homeowners association or something like that where you agree to pay a fee as a contingency of living in a community, something like that. That would be voluntary because you don't have to live in that community. You can live somewhere else. But government has never been voluntary. Taxation in America has never been voluntary. It's always been coerced. Was Rothbard a complete anarchist? Yes, he was. And not his whole life. As a young man, he was a limited government conservative for a while. He was even he even said that he was a socialist for a while when he was a teenager, as so many people were. Milton Friedman said he was too. But Murray Rothbard struggled with this idea of government possibly being limited by a constitution and decided that that was an impossibility and a fantasy. And he, of course, turned out to be right. The government has not been limited by the Constitution for generations now. And so he did become an anarchist in favor of the no government at all. Although at the same time, there is a group of libertarians that I sort of run across quite a bit who don't seem to be too interested in actually moving in the direction of greater freedom. In that if people like even Rothbard make a recommendation for a particular government policy that would move on, like reducing the average tariff rate from 50% to 5%, Rothbard would say that's a good thing. He would be criticized by the libertarians who say, aha, you're a sellout. You admit there should be some government of 5%. Rothbard was not one of those. He wanted to see increased freedom in his lifetime. And so when he would see proposals like this, he would praise people who would try to get policies like that put into place, even though he'd be condemned by a certain group of people whose motivation seems to be able to run around and strut around pretending to be holier than everyone else on libertarian issues. I'm more libertarian than you, Murray Rothbard, they would say. But Murray was practical. He was a great theorist. He was very philosophical, but he was also practical. He wanted to see greater freedom rather than less freedom. And he did not want the perfect to be the enemy of the good in terms of his comments he made on public policies. Let's see what else we have here. I have a big, long quotation. I'm not sure what this is from Mises to all participants, but from Robert Williams. Is the state a cultural? Well, it certainly is. My definition of the state, this is not Rothbard's, but the state of the purpose of government, rather. Purpose of government is for those who run it to plunder those who do not. There are all sorts of fanciful theories about the purpose of the state, but I think that's a more functional theory about the purpose of the state. How it gets its legitimacy, it lies to us about how benevolent and omniscient it is, and how evil and antisocial the civil society and private enterprise system are. That's how it gained its legitimacy. And since it has the ability to steal our money through income taxation or to print money counterfeiting-wise through the, central banking, it can pay a lot of people. It can bribe a lot of people to support its view that it is our savior, and that we as individuals need the state to save us from doom. Let's see what else we have here. What is the role of the state in today's society? It's pretty much to enrich itself and its minions at the expense of the rest of us. What is the state doing that is good? The cities in America are a wreck. The schools are horrible, crime is running rampant, garbage collection is usually putrid, the state governments are not much better, and the federal government is absolutely bankrupt. So the relationship between the state and the market, well, as I said, the state is always an enemy of the market. There may be a few exceptions every once in a while. There are a few politicians who are conservative or libertarian leading who are not quite as oppressive. But at the federal level, for example, you have over 200 years of accumulated powers over business through the regulatory and taxation apparatus. And so whoever runs the apparatus of regulation or of taxation could be any bozo, the clown type character like George W. Bush, for example. And they can do great damage because they have over 200 years of accumulated powers. Sometimes they use those powers and sometimes they don't, but they're always there. And so when you get somebody like Obama in, who is a, as my friend Yuri Maltsev says, a proud Marxist, well, he and his people will make the maximum use of all those accumulated powers to attack private business, and they are. That's exactly what they're doing, primarily for the benefit of various special interest groups that support them, such as public employee unions and private sector unions, for that matter. So that's what they will be doing. Eric wants to know, what hope is there ever of rolling back the state? Or you could have asked that to people in the Soviet Union 25 years ago, and they wouldn't have said there was much hope, but then the whole place imploded because of an economic crisis. And my opinion is that the only hope in my lifetime would be secession in groups of people, part of a state or combinations of states, simply say, keep your Medicare, keep your welfare state, keep your military empire, leave us alone, and we will live our own lives. And that's the only hope, in my view, is through acts of secession from the American empire. Simply picking one politician over another would work. Even if Ron Paul were elected president, in my opinion, the whole Washington establishment would work diligently day in and day out to sabotage everything he tried to do. And so there would be limited change. There would be good things that would happen, but I'm not too optimistic over the whole thing. Now, maybe you do have to wait for it to implode. That's what happened in the former Soviet Union. Have there ever been an example of a successful effort to reduce the growth of government? Yeah, the Soviet Union. The whole Soviet Empire imploded a couple of decades ago. That's a pretty successful effort to reverse the growth of government, I should say so. In history, one of the reasons Europe became so prosperous several hundred years ago was that government was highly decentralized. There were city-states. Not just states, but cities were independent. And that had a lot to do with the prosperity of Europe, because if one city was oppressive in terms of taxes, people could easily just flee to a less repressive place. They could vote with their feet, as the political scientists say. And so that had a lot to do with the success of Europe. But the whole trend since the middle of the 19th century in the world was sort of centralization. The American Civil War created a highly centralized bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. And then something similar was created in Germany a couple of decades later. And then not too long after that, something similar was created in the Soviet Union, in Russia, with the highly centralized bureaucracies. Excuse me again. And so that can be reversed. Devolution could occur. And that's the topic of our readings for next week, by the way. In fact, the essay by Clyde Wilson that I put on the reading list is entitled Devolution. And so the devolution of power is one way of thinking of things. Most people tend to think about left and right. Should we have Ron Paul in, or will Obama get elected? And if only we could get our guy in control of this giant bureaucracy, maybe he can turn things around. Well, an alternative way of thinking is vertically, in terms of devolving power away from Washington, D.C. altogether and putting it closer to into the hands of the people. And that's what occurred in Europe up until the 19th century. And that's the whole idea, the American idea of federalism is just that. Let's see, but another reason for changing wars between rulers involving the people rather than just the rulers, that costs the ruler less not only to have a conscripted army, but a volunteer army, the citizens being deceived into accepting less pay. Well, yeah, conscription was always a cheap way of enslaving people. If you could enslave people to be in your army, that might be better off, although the mercenaries, if they're professional soldiers, they're better soldiers because there would be a competitive market for mercenaries. And so you would have to, the rulers could shop around, so to speak. But with slave conscripts, they have no incentive at all to accumulate skills in the military arts because they're slaves, essentially. And so there is a trade-off there. On the one hand, it's cheaper, but you get what you pay for. You don't get as high a quality a person in your army if he's a slave. George Smith wants to know, was the Constitutional Convention a coup? Well, that's the theme of, if you read the book Mr. Jefferson by Albert J. Nock, he writes of the Constitutional Convention as being a bloodless coup. But just briefly in that book, a better place to read of Knox's view on this is Our Enemy, the State, in his book Our Enemy, the State, where he makes the case that it was a coup. If the Constitutional Convention was not totally a successful coup, however, because the leader of the Nationalists was Alexander Hamilton. And he proposed at the convention a permanent president or a king who would appoint all the governors, who in turn would have veto power over all state legislation. So you would essentially have had a king, and the states would have been puppet governments who just carried out the orders of the king. All power would have been centralized and monopolized at the center. And of course, we didn't get that. We got a system that was much more decentralized. So the coup participants wanted that. They wanted the Hamiltonian system And the reason they wanted that is they wanted to use that monopolistic governmental power to impose British-style mercantilism on America, with a central bank modeled after the Bank of England, high protectionist tariffs, and corporate welfare for selected businesses. That was Hamilton himself called that the American system, even though it was really the British mercantilist system brought to America. That's what they were up to. The Jeffersonians smoked them out early on, especially Senator John Taylor of Virginia, and Jefferson himself, of course, and they defeated them. They did not adopt that system. They eventually did. You know, by the time you get to the American Civil War, the whole Hamiltonian agenda was cemented into place, but that took another 70 years. The theoretical self-enforcing constitution, well, that's never a possibility. Somebody has to enforce the constitution. The original American idea was it would have to be mostly the people of the states organized in state and local political communities. But that was ended in 1865. And so the constitution from then on was interpreted by the federal government itself through its own Supreme Court. And the end result is the Constitution has become a rubber stamp on anything and everything the government wants to do. Excuse me again. Most recently, the president's wife even said a constitutional function of the federal government is handing out free breast pumps to pregnant women. And so if that is one of the delegated powers of the federal government, then everything is a delegated power of the federal government. Let's see what I got here. The name of the George Reisman piece, I'm not sure. If you look up George Reisman on the search engine of Mises.org, you'll find his article. I think Laissez-Faire was in the title, something like the myth that Laissez-Faire is responsible for the crisis. Nanny might run it down by tomorrow. I'll find it myself and send it along. Other examples in the history of large groups of people working without a government. Read an article in the Journal of Libertarian Studies by Terry Anderson and P.J. Hill entitled The Not-So-Wild Wild West, about the settlement of the American West before there was government. There's another book called Order Without Law by a law professor, who is it? I think it's Ackerman. I'm not exactly sure now. No, that's not Ackerman. Who is it? Look at it, you can find it, Order Without Law. It's about groups of people in Northern California, ranchers and farmers, who worked on all sorts of voluntary agreements to settle any disputes they had. And so those are a couple of examples off the top of my head of this sort of thing. Also, I would recommend looking up some of the writings of Bruce Benson on his book called The Enterprise of Law. It's about, a lot of it covers private law courts in history and how that worked. So it looks at different areas of society that were once voluntary and then were eventually taken over by the state. And that's one thing you can look into. Let's see there. Rothbard distinguished between the classical inception of the state as a polis or city and the one emerged out of the Hobbes Machiavelli. Well, I can't answer that. I don't really know. I can't think of where I can point to you of where he did that. When the state prints money, this is a question by Michael. The state prints money. So-called money printing or increasing the money supply, one of the things it does is it buys government bonds. So it puts money in the hands of people, and in return it gets government bonds. Okay, and so this is all done through Wall Street. And so the first group of people who get their hands on this money are investment bankers, for the most part, in and around Wall Street, who are connected with the government. Goldman Sachs, for example. That's why the U.S. Treasury Secretary is almost always the chairman of Goldman Sachs. And so they get use of this money, and they can leverage it, and they can make use of it and profit from it before price inflation. And then the money gets spent, and there is a multiplier effect. You know, it's spent on one, they spend some of the money, the people who receive the money spend it on buying cars and homes themselves, and then there's a third round of spending, and so all these rounds of spending are what eventually create price inflation, so that by the time it affects the average person out there, all we get is inflation, all we get is price inflation. But the original people who get their hands on that money first are the ones who always benefit. That's why the Wall Street investment bankers are so closely linked to the government. They benefit very handsomely from the whole scheme of the expansion of the money supply. That's why they're such supporters of the Fed. That's why it was mostly they who helped create the Fed in the first place in 1913. They stood to benefit more than anybody else from the existence of a bank run by politicians out of the nation's capital, and they do. There's a particular word for this process. It's called the Cantillon effect, named after a French economist named Richard Cantillon, spelled C-A-N-T-I-L-L-O-N. Mark Thornton has a couple of good articles on the Cantillon effect on the, in the Quarterly Journal of Wall Street Economics. If you want to do a search on the Mises.org web, you'll probably, or just the web, anywhere, you'll probably find Mark Thornton's articles on the Cantillon effect that explains how well this works. Excuse me again. See, Josh wants to know how we reconcile with libertarian socialists like Chomsky, who critique actions of the state but only seek to replace the corporatist influence with their own. Well, there are a lot of people, you know, much like Chomsky, who they'll criticize the state and sound very libertarian on some issues. But I don't trust Chomsky. I mean, he's good on some things. I read about him, or things by him, a lot that I agree with. And then I'll read other things by him where he calls for massive state intervention. So he's not a committed, he's not a consistent libertarian. He's a inconsistent libertarian. But I don't know what his motives are. I can't speculate on anybody's motives. John wants to know my views on direct democracy. It would be a horror. It's bad enough that the original American constitutional ideal was that democracy should be off limits to certain things. There should only be these delegated powers that we use democracy for. Everything else is left to the people. And the idea of direct democracy is, you know, voting on too many things. And it's, you have to understand that democracy itself is really just legalized theft. If two of us are walking down the street and we see the car owned by a third person, we break into the car, and that third person walks up and says, "Hey, what are you doing? That's my car." We respond by saying, "But we are Democrats with a small d. We believe in democracy. Let's take a vote on whose car it is." And so myself and the other person who are attempting to steal the car say, we vote, yes, it's our car. You're outvoted, therefore democracy rules, it's our car. What are you, a dictatorship? That's basically democracy. And so all democracy is evil, whether you call it direct or indirect, because it's legalized plunder, legalized theft. My views on unions. Unions are cartels of workers who historically have used violence, even murder, to keep out the competition. The only way unions can cause wages to go above a free market level is to use some sort of violence against competing workers to keep them from taking their jobs or competing with their jobs at a lower rate, at a lower pace. And so there's a long history of violence in the American union movement, and there's a big fat book written on it entitled Union Violence. The principal author is Armand Thiebold, T-H-I-E-B-O-L-D, and he's a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And he documents that the truth that unions in America have always had to resort to violence, and government has been in cahoots with them by often looking the other way or exempting them from laws that ordinary criminals would have to abide by saying that as long as it involves the pursuit of better wages and working conditions, it's okay. And so a lot of this violence has been allowed to happen in the name of the pursuit of better wages and working conditions. Of course, there are some exceptions. There are probably a few musicians unions around that are pretty peaceful, but by and large, that's what unions have been about in America. Go on Mises.org. You can find several articles of mine on unions. And so if you just type in my name and the word unions, you'll probably find that there are three or four of them in there to explain this in a lot more detail. Is there anything even remotely close to a libertarian leading government anywhere on earth? It is kind of an oxymoron. My old friend Yuri Maltsev used to be rather high on Estonia. He thought that of all the governments of Europe, at least years ago, he thought Estonia was pretty good compared to the others. Not perfect, but pretty decent. Chris Banco wants to know, what is the deal with the people at Reason? Cato claimed to be libertarians but putting down Rothbard. Well, you have to ask them, and putting down Ron Paul at every turn. David Gordon recently reviewed a book written by a couple of the Reason people, Nick Gillespie, and whose co-author it is, maybe it's Matt Welch. David Gordon on LouRockwell.com and probably on Mises.org also has his review of their book, and also on the blog on LouRockwell.com. These guys wrote in response to David Gordon, and then David Gordon responded back. So you can find out some insight into this question by looking at David Gordon's review of their book. Among other things, or even Steve Horowitz stating Rothbard wasn't that great of an economist. Well, that's funny. That's a good laugh. Horowitz was a student of mine 20-some years ago, George Mason, and he can't comparing him to Rothbard is like comparing an ant to an elephant. And so for someone like him who's unknown to almost everyone, to compare Rothbard is ridiculous. I do know that some of the reason people don't like Ron Paul because they define libertarianism differently than has been defined traditionally over the past 100 years or so. Part of their definition is that you have to be an advocate of certain lifestyles. Look up their article in Reason Magazine called 50 Heroes of Liberty. And they include Hugh Hefner and Larry Flint and Madonna and people like that. And so the traditional libertarian view is live and not live, is that the government should have no role in dictating lifestyles, what you do in your bedroom, what you do in your private life, as long as you're not harming somebody else. But their view is not that. Their view is that, no, you must be an advocate of these lifestyles, not just tolerant of them, but an advocate of, and that's what separates them from the Ron Paulians of the world. Who are the traditional libertarians who, the way I put it is, if you want to have sex with chickens, good luck. Have at it. It's none of my business. I could care less. And I certainly don't think the government should stop you from having sex with chickens. But a reasoned libertarian would say, well, no, to be a libertarian, you must be a champion of sex with chickens. You must be an advocate of that. And so that's my response to Chris's question here. Let's see, Bill says, Romney states that he would grant waivers to Obamacare. Yeah, that would be a form of nullification, not secession, but nullification. Of course, this is a politician making a campaign promise, so who knows what Romney would do. Joshua wants a breast pump, okay. How would David says, how would Rothbard deal with individuals who use force and fraud in a free market or a stateless society? Well, he's written on that. I mean, there, a stateless society does not mean there would be no means of enforcing moral behavior. Like I said, read the article by Terry Anderson and P.J. Hill entitled The Not-So-Wild Wild West, Journal of Libertarian Studies, 1979. It's online. It's a good example of how people created their own private policing mechanisms, and you're never going to have anything perfect on this earth, but they were pretty darn good compared to what we have today. And also, under that type of regime, under anarcho-capitalism, you would not have a government that could drop nuclear bombs on people and killing them a million at a time. And so, you know, compared to the existing regime, the stateless society would be totally wonderful in terms of crime and that sort of thing. You can't compare a stateless society with some sort of utopian ideal where you have perfect government. You have to compare it to a realistic type of government, which is the one we have now. Okay, here's the recent article. That's good. Okay, good. George Smith found the Not-So-Wild Wild West link. Oh, yeah, state education, of course, state control. Well, the universities are totally state controlled. I mean, I live in that sandbox, and your average college professor is a timid little weasel when it comes to criticizing the state. Those of us who actually do it are considered freaks by most of the other, or crazy people by the average bureaucratic weasel who is a college professor and who is pretty much counting the days to retirement. And college administrators always pressure, those, in some way, those of us who criticize the state because they receive so much money from the state. And so if you obtain money from the government to obtain a university education, well, it has to go to you have to go to a state-approved institution. That's what accreditation is all about. And so even if you don't realize it as a student, the institution you are going to has to be approved by the state. And so it can't be too politically incorrect. It has to be accredited in order to receive government money. Bob wasn't up, I would say a few words about corporate taxation. Well, corporate taxation, it's a clever way of hiding taxes because the corporation income tax is shifted mostly to factor owners, owners of the factors of production. This is sort of, there's a long explanation of this based on Austrian economics. But it's a myth that you can pass a tax on something called a corporation, and the idea that there are these big fat guys with bald heads chomping on cigars while sitting on their yachts who are going to pay the tax. It's the workers who work for the corporation will bear part of the burden. the factor suppliers who supply factors of production will pay part of the burden. The customers will pay part of the tax in the form of fewer products, worse products, or more expensive products. So the burden of that is spread around. And but it's an easy way for politicians to demagogue by making people think it's only the fat cats who are being made to pay their fair share. But the economics of it is that there's a very, very wide burden of such taxation. Yeah, there's not a dime's worth of difference between Obama and Bush, that's for sure, except for Obama escalated the wars that Bush started. Bill wants to know if any college universities accepted credits for Mises Academy classes. I don't know of any that have done this, but what I have told some of my students in the past, even with regard to the ones who go to Mises University in the summer, is find a professor, if possible, who will work with you on an independent study, and you can use one of these classes as you know, part of the proof that you have fulfilled the requirements of the independent study. Now, it usually requires some sort of paper to be written on the demonstrating you've learned something that's worth 3 credits. But I do that with my students if they take a course like this, or if they attend Mises University and get interested in a particular area, Austrian business cycle theory or whatever, then write a paper demonstrating what you learned. Get credit that way. And so far, I don't know that any universities will get course credit just for this this course, but you can turn it into credit if you find a professor who will work with you in that way. You know, I would like to see some sort of credit. You know, Eric is talking about American Council on Education. I think Doug French is looking into that to try to get that done. You know, and ideally, I would like to see the whole faculty of Mises University have become a degree-granting institution, granting, say, a master's degree in economics or even a PhD in economics, where students could take these online courses and then come to Auburn, you know, on occasion and consult with some of the professors and then, you know, do a final exam and a defense of a dissertation. I don't see why that couldn't be done. There are universities all over the place that are doing this, and so hopefully we can do it before too long. I think we're about running out of time. I have 9 o'clock, and that's the time we have allocated. But I guess it's a good time to wrap things up. Thank you all. Thank you all for participating. Thanks for the great questions. And I hope we'll have a good class next week, and hopefully my cold will be gone by then, and everything will be much clearer. Okay, and have a good week.